What have I been up to? What am I going to be up to? All sorts of things. I suppose I'm here today to teach you ways of being crazy and staying crazy for a lifetime, doing all the things people tell you not to do and making a career of them. So when I was a child, people told me not to collect comic strips, and I went ahead and did it. I have 37 years of Prince Valiant put away at home. I've been collecting Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and all these other things for a lifetime. Fell in love with motion pictures at an early age, and people told me not to love motion pictures, that they would never be an art form, and well, of course, they've turned into one. And along the way. And people told me not to write poems. Well, I couldn't stop myself when I was in high school. I belonged to a poetry club with six girls who were dogs and two boys of undetermined sex. and we were the weirdest kennel on the campus, the ugliest kids at LA High School. And the girls all wrote beautiful poetry, though, I must say. And I wrote lousy poetry. And it's taken me about 35 years to begin to write poetry that I enjoyed, and just doing it for myself all of that time. Fell in love with the theater when I was 10, 11, 12 years old. Wanted to be a boy magician, and went down, got a job on a radio station, and started writing plays when I was in high school. Nobody wanted my plays. Nobody still wants my plays. But that's okay. I write them for myself, and I save my money, and every few years I put them on somewhere just for my own pleasure and see if the damn things work, and they do. And I sit there, an audience of one, and I'm mightily pleased. So I have all these loves. I have a list of loves that have filled my life. I've been very fortunate. I've been able to shift gears every few days, every few weeks, every few months, every few years, and do a variety of things. And of course, science fiction was the big no-no in my life when I was in high school. Can you imagine how lonely I was among a student body of 4,000 people, none of them who ever read science fiction? I was the official class nut because I believed in space travel and that someday we would go off and land on the moon. But that was so far away. It was so far away. It was never going to happen. Space travel was never going to occur. We were never going to build rocket ships or do any of these crazy things. And then one of my other loves was horror stories, the sort of Phantom of the Opera thing. Edgar Allan Poe was a huge influence of mine. People said, oh, for God's sake, don't read that stuff, and don't write it, whatever you do. But all of my early short stories are stories written to scare the hell out of myself. It's a very important thing to do, isn't it? And we all love that. And it's amazing how many older people forget how important it is to be frightened. And I went off to see The Exorcist first time about a year ago, and I've seen it three times since. I think it's one of the most fantastic films I've ever seen. Scared the Jesus out of me. But that's grand fun. We all love that delicious thing of being afraid. So when you start a career, you begin to do all kinds of things just to scare yourself and to get these shadows out in the open so that you can begin to function on some other level. So I began to write a whole series of frightening stories, and I began my career in weird tales back around 1940-41. And along the way, let me give you an idea of some of the ways I get my stories, find my stories, and write them. When I was around 21 years old, I had a sore throat, went off to see my doctor, and I said, "Doctor, feel this, it feels awfully strange." And he felt it, and he shone a light on my throat, and he said, "You're suffering from," and I said, "Yes." He says, "A bad case." I said, "Yes." He says, "A bad case of discovery of the larynx." He says, "That's all perfectly normal in there. You've just never felt it before. If you touch this, and you got all these pieces of gristle and bone and ligaments and tendons and things in there, and you've got all these things about your body you've never paid any attention to." So I left him, and I was feeling all my bones, you know, feeling my elbows and my head and this crack across the top of your skull where the soft spot, I hope, closed in when you were about a month old, and my medulla oblongata on the back of my head and my knee bones. And then we all look at our feet and decide, my God, nobody likes their feet, do they? And most people don't like their noses for that much. And so I went home, and I wrote a short story about a man who discovered that he had lodged in the flesh of his body this horrible symbol of death for all time. He had a skeleton inside himself. Well, that scared the Jesus out of him, you know? And he'd never thought of that before. He looked in the mirror and he could see the skull looking back out at him from the mirror. So I wrote a story then about a competition between this man and his skeleton to see who was going to win, whether the skeleton was coming out in the open or was going to stay lodged in the intellectual flesh. Well, as a result of going with this thing, I wrote the only story that I know of in the history of literature about a man having a competition with his skeleton. I mean, if you can find a story like that somewhere, as crazy as that, you tell me where it is. But out of that kind of nightmare, I wrote a series of stories which became part of a book called October Country, in which I celebrated terror, in which I looked at myself in the mirror and pulled out all the shadows from the corners of my mind and did short stories of these ideas, which is a great way to live, isn't it? And a lot of you have to begin the same way in your various careers, as actors, as painters, as writers, whatever. If you're in any of the arts, sometimes you start with the shadows, you start with the nightmares, and pull them out one at a time. So I have a lid on my head, and I lift this the lid on the top of my skull, and I pull out a Tyrannosaurus Rex, one at a time, and skin the damn thing and nail it on the wall, and then go on to the next nightmare. So every single one of these early stories, then, is an exercise in nightmare so that I could begin to live in the sunlight. Because when we're 17, 18, 20, 21 years old, we're full of shadows still. We suddenly discover death means us. We've had a few friends die on us. So you have to lay those shadows, make do with them. So I have had a series of careers, then, built on mistakes, on errors, on wrong ways of thinking, on bad taste, on people telling me not to do these things, but I had to do them anyway because I was doing something that I loved, that was delicious to me. So in the field of frightening stories, in the field of science fiction, in the field of poetry, in the field of drama, you name it, I've been doing everything wrong for a lifetime, and it's been a great life as a result. Living by my emotions and bringing my passions out on display, not being afraid of my passions, living with the murder inside myself, nailing that to the wall, and then standing back and looking at it and saying to myself, what have I done? What have I done? Plenty of time to intellectualize, plenty of time to do that in between times. But in the creative act must be passion and dedication and love and zest and gusto of living to the top of your feelings within the art form. So that I've had 40 years or so of never working a day of my life, of having fun every day of my life by living and working and creating in this way. I can only wish the same thing for many of you who are going into art forms. It applies to many other fields, of course, too. But by making passionate choices, not intellectual choices, and then driving through to the finish of these things, and when finished, then standing back and saying, what have I done? I've had a good life. Now, let me give you a few other examples of the sort of thing that I've done over a period of time, how I get ideas. I was walking along a street in Los Angeles about 25 years ago with a friend late at night around along Wilshire Boulevard near Western. We were talking. Police car pulled up. Policeman got out of the car, came over and said, what are you doing? And I said, putting one foot in front of the other. Well, that was the wrong answer. You mustn't be flip. And the more the policeman spoke to me, the more irritated I got. And I said, we're out looking, and we're walking, and we're enjoying ourselves, and we're conversing. Well, none of these answers were right either. And so I looked around, and I suddenly realized how isolated we were on the sidewalk. For 10 miles in that direction, not a soul. 10 miles in that direction, nothing. Dogs up the nearest street, yelping hysterically. They hadn't seen a pedestrian in years. And so I got so irritated at the interview that was going on with a policeman that I took a small package of soda crackers from my pocket, popped them in my mouth, chewed, and sprayed him with soda crackers. As I talked very rapidly, and this constellation of little soda crackers just covered his uniform. Large Andromeda Nebula here, Orion over here. And the policeman looked down and looked at me and couldn't decide whether I was being hostile or not. Because after all, what's a soda cracker, you know? It doesn't really hurt. And he brushed the flakes off, reprimanded me, and said, I mustn't do it again. I said, yes, sir, I'll never walk again in my life. And I went home, and I was in a rage. I was in a rage. And this is where, you know, living on by your emotions can help, because sometimes you can't express them in public, but you can sure as hell get them on paper. And I wrote a short story called The Pedestrian, and laid it 40, 50 years in the future, in which we're living in a time when it's against the law to walk, period. And of a story of a man who goes out and dares to walk and is finally trapped and carried away for psychiatric investigation. At the end of the story. Well, the next step from that is the beautiful one, because about a year later, I took that pedestrian out for another walk in a story, changed his sex to a girl named Clarice McClellan, had her walking late at night, scuffing the leaves. She smells the smell of kerosene, and around the corner the other way comes Montag from the firehouse. And 9 days later, I finished writing Fahrenheit 451. So thank God for that policeman, who stopped me, made me mad, and I wrote not only a story, but a novel. So this is a great way to live, isn't it, Getting intensely mad, or being wildly in love. If any of you are writers here, or painters, or actors in any field, what a great way to live, to make a list of the 5 things you hate most, and then kill them, in a story, Get rid of this thing, just one at a time, just line them up and shoot them down. That's what a hell of a lot of our art is about. And then make a list of the 5 things you want to celebrate most, the 5 things you love most. Let me give you another example of this sort of thing. Like a fool, and indeed I was foolish, I went to dinner about a year ago with the president of the ABC network. I don't even remember his name. They keep changing the presidents all the time anyway. And in the middle of the evening, he said to me, if I gave you an hour's time on television, what would you do with it? And I thought for a moment, and I said, dinosaurs. Dinosaurs. My God, we all love dinosaurs, don't we, Jesus Christ, there's nothing better than a dinosaur. Every child, every man, every woman in the history of the world, if we had a choice of places to go, you get in a time machine, you go back and find a dinosaur, and have a conversation with it. You talk and it eats. And I've always wanted to meet one. You know, this is the terrible thing of our lives. Every time we go to the museum and look at those bones standing there, we think, oh my God, if they would only move, if we really could see one. So I said, just give me an hour's time and I'll do you the damnedest show on dinosaurs that's ever been done. I'll bring my friend Ray Harryhausen over from London. I've known him since we were teenagers. For those of you who don't know his name, he is the wonderful person who creates the beasts and monsters and dinosaurs that are in films like Mighty Joe Young, and Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, Jason and the Argonauts, Mysterious Island. Well, we've known each other since we were both 17. And he used to build these dinosaurs, and they'd run around the backyard and chase his dad and eat him. So this is the kind of background I come from, of intense loves about crazy things. We used to telephone each other and talk for hours. You know, men are always making fun of women talking on the phone for long periods of time, but it's just not true. Men do just as much talking, boys do just as much talking, but about other things, of course. And we talk dinosaurs all the time. And he wanted to grow up and be the greatest animator of dinosaurs in the history of the world, emulating his hero, Willis O'Brien, who animated The Lost World in 26 and King Kong in 1932. And by God, he grew up and became this, and now is known all over the world. And they're having Ray Harryhausen dinosaur festivals all over the world on university campuses. So there you are. You see how I live? I don't let anyone turn me away. ABC never called me back. I haven't done the dinosaur show yet. But I will. I'm going to do all these crazy things I've always wanted to do. I still have a list of things up ahead that I want to do. That would be one of them. Another would be a film on ancient Egypt, on the tombs and the mummies and the hierarchies, the dynasties. We're all fascinated with the Egyptians, aren't we? I think we all share that love, male or female. You can make a list of 7 or 8 things like that I would like to do. And then, of course, my favorite holiday, to hell with Christmas, my favorite holiday is Halloween, huh? All right. Now, you can go in the library right now with your crazy love. See, this is the thing I'm trying to, the point I'm trying to make is, you have a crazy love inside you today as you're listening to me here. You won't even speak of it half the time to your friend. You're ashamed of this crazy love. You're ashamed and you're afraid people are going to make fun of you. Your best friends or your girlfriend, your boyfriend, or your relatives or a teacher, whatever it is. So you hide this thing away. And what I want you to do is vomit it out. For Christ's sake, get it on display and go nuts with the thing, huh? If you love dinosaurs, for God's sake, love them. If you love ancient Egypt, become an archaeologist. Become this mad person that scrabbles around in the bones of the world. You only have only this one life. You're going to be dead in a few years. All too quickly, it's over. So make your lists of these enthusiasms. More than one. What the hell? Why shouldn't you have more than one enthusiasm? I wanted to be a magician when I was 10. Went up on the stage and helped Blackstone saw people in half, huh? And became a boy magician. Wanted to work on radio. Went down and hung around the radio station. Told all my friends I was going to be a radio actor. At the age of 12, I did this. With no help from my parents. With no help from my friends. I was a mad boy, huh? Now I'm a madman. And 2 weeks later, by God, I was on the radio every Saturday night doing what? Reading the comic strips to the kiddies, huh? And getting free tickets to The Mummy and King Kong and all those good movies, huh? So, from all this horse manure, I have grown careers. I have grown careers. I have dared to be foolish. So, dinosaurs, ancient Egypt, all kinds of fantasy, rocket ships. Also, anything that comes into my head that I feel like writing about, I write it. I did a new play, which put on over at Cal State Fullerton a year ago, called Pillar of Fire. It's the story of the last dead man in the world. All the graveyards of the world are being vacated by the clean-thinking people, the wonderful intellectuals who don't want us to have myths and legends, don't want us to be afraid of anything, huh? Don't want us to enjoy Halloween. So they're clearing out all the graveyards, and they're burning all the bodies, and this dead man wakes up in the middle of the graveyard and discovers that he represents the Cask of Amontillado and the Monkey's Paw and Dracula and Frankenstein's monsters, and that he is the last symbol of all of these grotesques in the history of the world. And he sets out to form an army of the dead to go against the super intellectuals who are ruining all the fun, huh? Who are spoiling Halloween, who are spoiling Christmas, who are spoiling the 4th of July, who are taking all the gusto out of life. And at the end of the story, he is trapped and wrapped around with mummy cloths, and they stand in front of this great hearthing oven. They're going to shove him into the flames. And as they wrap these mummy cloths around him, he stands like this and says, "I am the Cask of Amontillado. I am Rappaccini's daughter. I am Dracula. I am Frankenstein's monster. I am the black cat. I am all these dark shutters that ever banged on an old house at midnight. I am the mouse squeaking in the basement. I am the lid that opens on attic caverns. I am the wind in the eaves on Halloween night." And they shove him in the furnace, and he goes in. He cries out, "For the love of God, Montresor!" Oven closes, and we hear from a policeman on the side, "For the love of God, Montresor." So you see the kind of plays I write? It's ridiculous, isn't it, huh? Just for me. Boy, that's not exactly in, is it, huh? It's not an in play. It's not a Beckett play. It's not a Pinner play. It's a Bradbury play. It's just pure me. And if you don't like it, to hell with you, huh? I've shown you the crazy things I write. I just finished a short story. I've been fascinated with all kinds of people, with Shakespeare and with Melville. 21 years ago, I did the screenplay of Moby Dick for John Huston. That was my first big screen job. And fell in love with Shakespeare and with Melville all over again. It's fascinating why I want you to bury yourself in all kinds of impulses and influences from all the arts, the more you can take in from your library, the more you can take in from your friends, from your teachers, from experiences anywhere in the world, the more mulch you can cram into your head, shove in your eyeballs, and blow out your ears, the more chances you will have of raising yourself up. Now, I'm a child of the libraries. I've never made it to college. I'm totally library educated. When I left high school, there was no way of my ever getting to a college. This is back in 38, in the middle of the really Great Depression, when I think that the month that I left school, there were around 15 million people unemployed in a nation where there were only 125 million people, about half the population of today. It was a scary time. So I have run amok in libraries, though, and spent a lot of time in the children's section, not in the intellectual section necessarily over on the other side. To hell with them, you know. They're mostly bores. Put you right to sleep, huh? Stick with the kids. I looked with, my heroes are Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, and Robert Louis Stevenson, and Mark Twain. That's plenty good company for me. And if I can pick up with a G.K. Chesterton and a Shakespeare and a George Bernard Shaw to mix with all these other fabulous children, well and good. So I've had these incredible influences from these varieties of people I've told you about. And then I collided with Melville. And in the middle of writing the Moby Dick screenplay, I discovered, it's quite obvious when you read the book, that Shakespeare is standing behind him and breathing over his shoulder. And when I finished the film, I discovered only a few years ago that indeed, in the middle of writing a book on the whaling industry, Melville went to Boston and read Shakespeare for the first time. His eyes were very weak. And books 100 years ago had very small types. So if you had bad eyes, forget it. You just never got around to reading Shakespeare. You could have someone read them to you. So he got 7 volumes of Shakespeare and took them home and read them, and he took his whaling book and threw it out the window. And during the next 8 months, Moby Dick was born, and Ahab and the Pequod, all because of one of these influences I'm talking to you about today. I want a lot of things to go into your heads on a lot of levels, out of your own enthusiasm. And the amazing thing is, the more you run amok in libraries, pulling books here and books there, the more it's like eating Cracker Jack. You can't stop. You begin to recycle yourself, turning yourself over and over and over. I want lots of influences, lots of enthusiasms. I want you to go crazy in libraries. Now, I've written a poem on the influence of Shakespeare on Melville, which proves one of the points I'm discussing here. And I won't do the whole thing, just part of it. But I think it's amazing, the influence of this one writer on this other writer who is now considered to be among the top 5 American writers of all time. At first there were but whales, and now a whale. At first there was but sea and tides by night, but now the fountains of Versailles somehow set sail and sprinkled all the vasty deeps at 3 a.m. with souls pure jets. At first there was no captain of the ship which named Pequod set sail for destinations, not for God. But God obtruded, rose, and blew his breath, and Ahab rose full-born to follow death, no dark opinions, seek in the strangest salt dominions for one beast. Oh, and from what was a simple-minded breakfast, oh, Jesus, mild and tempered sweetmeats, now a feast. How came it so that from such crumbs tossed forth at morning such great nightmare terrors grow? What was a cat toy lost upon old summer lawns has through one season grown to monster size to panic color all gray Melville's dawns. Why, Willie happened by. That is the end, the explanation, and the all. As blind almost as Homer, Herman never read the good or bad or in between Othello, the dead put down by Richard III, Iago's boast, never gone out at midnight in his mind, had Ahab, with a small a, stumbled and fallen blind against mad Hamlet's father's murdered ghost. But now, in 7 volumes of large size, and large, O gods, the fount of type, the words, the trumpetings of metaphor and doom, all that was microscopic filled his room. All that had filled his room now filled his mind, from south to west, then east, and now the panic north. Shakespeare, beneath his window, gave this shout, O Lazarus, Herman Melville, truly come ye forth. And what's that with you? Dreadful gossamer, funeral wake, or arctic veil? What, this? Why, Jesus, lily of the valley breath, it seems to be a whale. And what a whale! A true-born beast of God. Shakespeare stood back away as Herman trod a path and made a launching spot a maze. We're into lose, then find Titanic, Moby, and then send him down the ways. So off and round the world ran two men wild, skinned in one Lazarus flesh, one loud, one mild, each summoning the other, and neither knowing which was elder, therefore evil, wiser brother, until flukes out black blood from mutual toil, they brought a miracle of fish to boil, like God who spoke and uttered light, these twins in unison said night, and there was night. That night in which great panics birthed and hid, that dawnless hour from which old Moby slid and knocked the world half off its axis into awe, and all because dear Willie stuck his metaphor down Herman's craw. And I'm here today to make the metaphors to stick down your throats and to get you to vomit out your lives, huh? So I vomit now and clean up later. I want you to upchuck. I want you to create. I want you to be passionate beings, to live to the top of your experience. Because you're not going to have many chances, and you're going to regret it later. If you don't listen to me today, you're getting this advice free, right? Huh? You're getting this... or very cheaply. If you don't listen to me today, 30 years from now, you're going to have to pay $50 an hour for the same advice. You're going to have a wife or husband you hate, kids who hate you, a psychiatrist who's bleeding you, a mistress or boyfriend who also hates you, because the dream died. The passionate thing in you that you wanted, you never tried because you were afraid. Well, why not? Why not try it, Why lead your life by other people's opinions of what you should be doing? It can't be done, can it? Can't be done. I wish it could, but it can't. So to hell with all that. If I can excite you to experiment with your passions, with your feelings about certain careers that you want for yourself, I think I will have done a fairly good job today. Because you don't want to grow old and bitter, do you? You don't want to grow old and unhappy. That would be a hell of a way to grow old. So I've had the best of lives as a result of doing all these things, collecting all these things, being all these things. I've just finished a new short story about a guy who goes off in space in a huge starship on it for a two-year journey, and everyone else on the ship late at night, they have these amorous girl toys to play with, these big robot girls. And he goes down below late at night, and he stands and he calls into this little storage space under the turbines to this old man sitting there. It's old man robot with a red beard. And he says, "Mr. Shaw, Mr. George Bernard Shaw." And this robot wakes up, and it's the robot of George Bernard Shaw. And they sit and they talk late at night. And Shaw does the prefaces to all of his plays and declaims from Don Juan in Hell, or you name the play, And they have a beautiful intellectual time, and he's the oddball aboard the rocket, of course. Everyone says, "What is he doing down there with this strange old intellectual robot man late at night? Why isn't he playing with all these fantastic toys above stairs?" And at a certain moment, when they're standing and looking at the stars, my young hero turns to George Bernard Shaw and says, "Say it, Mr. Shaw." And he says, "Say what?" He says, "You know what I like to hear." And Shaw looks out at the universal deeps where God is turning in his sleep. He says, "All right, I'll say it." He says, "What are we? What are we? What is mankind? We are matter and force making ourselves over into intelligence and will. Matter and force making itself over into intelligence and will. So much of the universe is blind, blind motion, blind energy that knows not itself. And we are the thing that turns in the long night of the universe, the thing that awakes, the thing that would know itself, the thing that knows and knows that it knows." So in all the universe, We are that small parcel of flesh, the energy and the matter that until mankind on this planet occurred, did not know itself. And now we become intelligent. Now we will ourselves to do things. And we go through our world and the universe doing them. So Shaw says all this, and he's a threat, of course, to all the other people on board because all they ever do is talk. Huh? It's just talk, beautiful talk. And some of the people on board try to destroy the robot Shaw and succeed in temporarily killing him. And a flight of meteors hits the rocket ship and blows it up. And my hero is left in space, falling through space, the only survivor, with his oxygen helmet on and his food capsules with him. And the robot Shaw falls into his arms. In the huge concussions and explosions and gyrations of the craft, the robot is flung into his arms, and the collision with the meteors has caused the wires inside Mr. Shaw to fuse back together again, and he begins to talk. Huh? And he says to the young man, "How much food do you have on you?" And the young man says, "Oh, I have enough food for 200 days falling through space." "How much energy do you have, Mr. Shaw?" And Mr. Shaw says, "Oh, 10,000 years. I have these solar cell eyeballs. You can drink in God's light of the universe and feed myself energy. I'll be alive and yammering and gibbering and stuttering and talking and doing my prefaces for the next 10,000 years. So how much food have you got? You got enough food for the 200 days? You got enough oxygen?" "Yes." "It recycles itself." "It does." So they fall away down through space in each other's arms. The old man is talking and saying the same thing again about matter and force, making itself over into intelligence and will. And the old man spoke, and the young man listened, and the young man spoke, and the old man hooted. And they fell away around a corner of universe, away out of sight, eating and talking, talking and eating. The young man biting gumball foods, the old man devouring sunlight with his solar cell eyes. And the last that was seen of them, they were gesticulating and babbling and conversing and waving their hands until their voices faded into time. And the solar system turned over in its sleep and covered them with a blanket of dark and light. And whether or not a rescue ship named Rachel, seeking her lost children, ever came by and found them, who can tell? Who would ever truly want to know? That's the end of the story, huh? That's a story I've just finished and sent out. I don't know where in hell I'm going to sell it. I never know. I just send the stories out and hope that somebody wants them, which is true for my poetry. I'm still getting rejection slips every week of my life. I know that's hard to believe, but anyone wants to see one, just write me and I'll send you one. I'd be glad to get it out of the office. My God, the time has gone very swiftly. We should have one or two questions before it gets too late. I'll tell you this, at 1 o'clock, I take it a heck of a lot of you have to leave. But those few of you who might want to stay behind for a moment, if you gather down in the first few rows, we could continue for a few more questions. I realize we do have a time problem here. Let's have a few questions right now. I've stunned you. Yeah, all right. Well, I love the concept, and of course, after the first year, the networks interfered, didn't they? I think you've heard about all this, and Mr. Roddenberry got discouraged and finally pulled out. He's a lovely man. He's a very sweet, very kind, very bright man. But you can only fight so long, and if people change things behind your back and take away all your money, there's not much you can do. So the idea was always good. Yes. An ego? You can't survive without one, can you? Huh? Huh? First of all, at your age especially, but at any age, if you don't believe in yourself, if you don't have an image of yourself, the world can never have one. The world can't believe in a person who disbelieves in himself. The problem with Nixon was he never believed in himself, right? It's true. It's very sad. But we know this, that he disbelieved so much that he felt he had to do some of these things which were totally unnecessary. He could have won that election hands down without moving, right? But he didn't believe it. So again, there was no ego there. There was never any, if he'd had an ego like the Kennedys have, huh? They've always had a very good self-image and able to project that and survive. You don't have to do all that other nonsense. So, yes. I don't trust cars and airplanes. Well, I don't drive and I don't fly, if that's what you mean. And I don't smoke, but I go around pinching girls' buns all the time. I don't think that's egotistical. It's sheer survival. Yes. Well, your library here has 7 or 8 reference books. Just ask the librarian, and my address is in every one of those, okay? Yeah. Yes?
I have no question, but just tell me a dream.
Tell me
a dream.
A dream?
Your biggest one.
For myself, or for all of us?
For yourself and for
us. Oh, well, my dream for my... No, it's one and the same. My dream for all of us is to survive to the year 2000, number one. Huh? But no, we'll make it. I'm going to depress you all with my optimism, sorry. First of all, I cannot accept doomsayers because they are not constructive. I am a constructive a critic. You know I've lambasted the hell out of our various societies during the last 30 years. But I always believe in the minute of criticism of offering alternatives. If I don't do that for you, I can't help you. I can't help myself. How are we going to make it through the end of the century? We have to find constructive ways of willing ourselves. Go and look it up in Toynbee. Toynbee put it beautifully. If a culture does not respond to a challenge, it is doomed. We must respond with our intelligence and our will, what Mr. Shaw was talking about here. We have the intelligence, we can will ourselves to do all kinds of things. Anything we decide to do, at the start of World War II, President Roosevelt announced we were going to produce 1,000 airplanes a week, 52,000 a year. Totally impossible. We were only making about 4,000 a year at that time. Everyone says, come on, cut it out. What are you smoking, huh? Well, we willed ourselves to do it, and we did it. It's true with all of our ecological problems. Anything we want to solve, the energy problem, if we want to solve it, we will ourselves to solve it, and we will solve it. Now, if we don't will ourselves, we will fail. It's just that direct. There's a failure of imagination, failure of will, failure of belief here on all sides in both parties. And I will you to do better. You're going to take over here, right? And I demand of you imagination. The same sort of thing Jules Verne talked about in his novels. It's so great and why we love going back to that man. What does he say? He says, you have a brain, use it to instruct your heart. You have a heart, use it to warm your thinking. You have hands, change the world. Head, heart, hands, take the whole goddamn thing and change it. Change it. Now you may leave. Thank you very much.
Has it evolved to this?
We're all set.
Are we all set?
Yeah. Wonderful.
What did you ask?
I did.
You did.
Okay.
Why did I ask him?
No.
Well, why did you come?
Because I asked him to.
Okay.
That's a good reason.
He had nothing else to do. He was in the neighborhood, thought he'd drop by.
Sure.
Well, this is great so far. why don't you start out?
Mr. Bradbury, sounds like you've been writing plays a little bit more lately than usual.
The last 10 years. Actually, 15 years. And mainly I'm getting produced in colleges nowadays a lot around the country.
There was one play that I saw that you did quite a long time ago. It had the pedestrian and the Chicago Abyss and the time machine in.
Right.
That was
10 years ago.
Yeah,
at the
really
Cornet in L.A. Yeah.
Yes.
It was my own theater. It's the only way to do it. Just start your own theater.
Do you write generally for a small audience? Or,
I mean, you don't write for any audience. You just write a play.
You don't like the one you said you did at Cal State. You didn't write for the Cal State Theater Department.
No, I've been working on that particular play, Dandelion Wine, for about 8 years. And Burgess Meredith came into my life about 8 years ago, and he brought me a composer and a lyricist. And he said, hey, these guys love your book. Why don't you do something with them? So it took about a year of messing around. And then I've learned to write songs with some of these people. So I'm intrigued with all kinds of music. And I've had meetings during the last 3 years, and I've got to know people like Cat Stevens. I knew Mama Cass 14 years ago when she started her career. I've known Chad and Jeremy. Some of my daughters know some of the Beatles. You know, there's a wonderful mixture here. I'm working with Lalo Schifrin on a thing. I've worked with Jerry Goldsmith on a cantata. I'm getting into all kinds of new directions in theater and in music and in writing plays. Just anything that's intriguing. I'd like to do a grand opera. I'd like to do something as great as Tosca sometime. Now, I wouldn't be doing the music. I'd be doing the libretto. But I'm trying to find the ghost of Puccini right now, wherever he is. And if I can get a good Ouija board, I'll write the opera. Huh? But I'm old-fashioned in that respect. I like a good melody, and I would love to do a grandiose science fiction opera. That put 2001, on the stage as an opera, or something like it. So you see, I've got plenty of things that I would like to do still, plenty of enthusiasms. I haven't run out of them.
Well, I get the impression from your talk and from listening that you don't really care so much about what other people think of writing, and you don't think people should care that much about what other people think of their writing.
All you have to go on is your own love. You can't learn. You can learn something about love from other people. You can learn something about enthusiasm from other people. But if someone, well, I'll give you a good example. John Huston offered me Moby Dick. I'd never read the book. I said, I don't know if I can do it. I'll go home and read as much as I can. Went home and read almost half the book in one night, came back the next day and said, yes, it's Shakespeare. I'm in love. I can do it. I was offered War and Peace a year later, the American production with King Vidor was directing with Henry Fonda and American cast. And I turned it down. Why? I do not love War and Peace. It's just that simple. You cannot teach me to love War and Peace, you see. Your love is not enough. You may be mad for the novel, but your love cannot instruct me. There's no way for it to. If I grow another year or two and grow new feelers inside myself and come back to War and Peace on my own terms and fall in love later, well and good. But it's like the Tolkien series. You know, I say, oh my God, you got to read Tolkien. Well, no, I don't. I don't. I just don't. And I never will. He's a bore to me. But that's sacrilege, you know. My Christ, you don't dare say that. Well, there are a lot of boring things around. The new Young Frankenstein is out. I love Mel Brooks. He's a madman. He's crazy. But Young Frankenstein is not very good. I love the producers better. He's the first film. It's sublime. It has great, great moments, truly great moments. So you got to make these differentiations, and I would love to work with Mel Brooks. Maybe we just babble all day for 6 months and never do anything, but I'd love to be around him. This is the stuff you got to go with, but no one can teach you that.
Well, you've been into new directions, I guess, for about the last 10 years or so, with poetry and plays. Does this mean that you're not really concerned at all with going back and doing anything like what you were doing in the 50s or 60s, or seeing any of your earlier works put on film or anything like that?
No, I'm doing, many of the plays are extensions of my earlier work. In some cases, they're adaptations of really short stories. I find that most of my short stories adapt very well to the theater and adapt especially well to motion pictures. So I've just finished adapting Something Wicked This Way Comes as a screenplay, which I hope will finally get made this year. I've just done this new play called Kaleidoscope. For staging, well, the story of seven men who fall through space when their rocket explodes. And then the Shaw thing is an extension of that, isn't it? You see, variation on a theme. So I'm using science fictional themes and carrying them to the next step, combining two old enthusiasms, rocket ships and Shaw. I'm going to be doing, I hope to start work during the next 2 weeks. On a two-hour documentary on the horror film, the history of the horror film, with William Friedkin, who did The Exorcist. And so we'll be paid for sitting in a dark room watching old films and having fun, you know. That's criminal, isn't it? It's gorgeous. So, but again, I wouldn't do it, you see. If you offered me a chance to do a history of the Western film, it would be much harder for me to do. And I would probably turn it down. Not that I haven't loved certain Westerns. I have. And if you said, how about doing a history of the detective film? Oh, wow, that would be great, because I know Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald and James King. And these are in my blood, intensely in my blood. You see, I read each of their books 10 times. Well, you got to love a thing to read it 10 times, right? You just don't play around. And that's what all life has to be like. It's, you never mess around with anything except your intense loves. And if you do anything else, you're doomed. You're just going to screw yourself. If you live for anyone else, that fat-headed old Christian thing of you got to go out and do things for people, that's a lot of crap. It never has been true. And you'll destroy your lives. The people will hate you for doing them favors, and you'll hate yourself for perverting your life to the customs of others. It doesn't work. It just doesn't.
Mr. Bradbury, you were saying that what one should do is go out and work with one's loves. Well, have you ever had to work with something that wasn't a love because of financial need? Has that ever happened?
No, and one should resist doing that. And there are no such financial needs most of the time. You just decide to starve quietly during part of your life. I sold newspapers for 3 years on a street corner in L.A. from the time I was 19 until I was 22. I made $10 a week. Well, if that isn't dedicating myself to my craft, I don't know of anyone that ever has. And as soon as I began to make $11 a week at writing, I quit the corner, you see. But my income at writing was only $30 a week until I was 27, and only $40 a week till I was 29, and $50 a week, or between 50 and 75, until I was 32. That's kind of late, isn't it, huh? And by the time I was 33, I was making $100 a week at writing. And I thought I was rich, huh? So you don't need furniture in the house. When we moved into a tract house when I was 30 years old, for 3 years we had no furniture in most of the rooms. And when people came over, we sat on the floor, or we took them into a little side room and sat them down. In other words, you got to know what's important. Furniture is not important. Cars are not important. Clothes are not important, huh? Until such time as you can afford to buy them. Sickness is the only importance that can hurt all of us and destroy all of us. And if you're lucky, you don't have a destructive illness. And if you're unlucky, you're screwed, no matter what, whether you're a writer or anything else. There's where you need your money. And if you came to me and said, hey, my mother's in the hospital and the bills are $8,000 and we have no money in the bank, can I go sell myself any way I can to get that money? I say, go do it. You know, you got to get it, that's all. So I say, go take the crappiest job in TV, write the lousiest book if you have to, but the survival of life in illness is the most important thing then. And then it's okay to sell out.
You've been freelance from the beginning, or do you have a journalism background?
No journalism. That'll kill everything that's good in you. Stay away from it. It's a lot of work. Well, I mean, it's just writing facts, you know. It rained today. The sky was blue. The man came in the room, sat down. He picked up. So most writing and most novels is reportage, and that's why it's so crappy bad. You can't tell any of these writers one from the other. It's all just objective writing. He looked out the window. The sky was black. He turned. He lit a cigarette. That's not writing, huh? That's what Truman Capote says, that's typing. Huh? Yeah. I always, who are you? What are you? What are your dreams? These have to go into the stories. This Shaw story I read today is intensely personal, isn't it? That's me and Shaw, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's an idealization of how I would like to end my life. If I could fall through space gibbering with George Bernard Shaw and looking on the wonders of God, Jesus Christ, is that a personal vision or isn't it? Okay, no one else has written a story like that. This is absolutely me, and that's what you're looking for. And reportage and journalism will never give it to you.
Do you still have a large percentage of rejections for each story that's accepted?
Yep, 4 or 5 per story. I got 3 or 4 stories out now that haven't sold. They've been out in around 3 or 4 months. I'm sure the Shaw thing will be rejected by several places. I don't think Playboy will want it. It's too intellectual, huh? They've published, 30 of my stories. I love the magazine. It's very liberal in the best sense of that term. Liberal in every sense of that term. Magazine. But there's not enough here, I think, for them to want to use the story. I don't know. Maybe I'm guessing wrong. I hope not. I would like to sell them again. It's been a couple of years.
You said during your talk today that you don't fly and you don't drive. I wonder if you had the opportunity to take a trip in a rocket ship, being as fascinated as you are with science fiction and space travel, would you do it?
It'd be awfully tempting, especially toward the end of my life, if I thought, well, we'd blow up and be spread all over the
make Last Sunset. You know, people look up and say, my God, see that color there? It's Old Ray. Old Pink, we call him. That for you, Mayor Yording.
Have you been following science fiction for the last 15 or so years, or are you just too far off into new things?
Oh, you follow it, but you try not to read too much of it because you don't want to imitate it. You don't want to borrow other people's ideas. So mainly what most of us do is read in other fields and bring into the science fiction field what we learned from Dylan Thomas or Robert Frost or George Bernard Shaw. I'm bringing in from Shakespeare and Melville all the time into my own field, the things I've learned from them. Or philosophers, just books of philosophy, Bertrand Russell, Bergson. I've done a short story based on something I discovered in Bergson, the creative evolution. Desjardins, Kazantzakis, you know, any cross-pollination that's good. But you don't want to be incestuous. You read too many of your own people. And anyway, there's so much science fiction around on television, you can't escape. Mission Impossible has been science fiction all the way through. The Avengers is on every night now. That's pure science fiction. The James Bond series in theater, you know, it's all science fiction. And anytime you take an idea, any kind of idea, and give it a twist, unusual, using machinery in interesting ways, using technologies in interesting ways, or doing new things with old concepts, you're writing science fiction.
Are there any authors today that you think of as particularly good or bad or that strike you in any way?
All the New York writers are crap, almost without exception. Norman Mailer, Philip Roth,
John Updike,
Saul Bellow, bores. I never want to read them again. I never want to see them again. For Christ, are they awful.
Aren't they profound?
Aren't they what?
Sorry.
Jesus. Well, what I wish is that the whole island of Manhattan would slowly sink out of sight. The last thing we'd see is John Updike waving a flag on top of the Empire State as Kong sits on it. So, no, they're so insular, you know, and the great thing about the Western writers, people from our part of the world, is we're still free. We're not bound up with the New York intellectual critics and all that crap. And most of the midstream, mainstream American writing is boring because it's self-conscious. It's intellectual. It's the worst kind of writing there is. Norman Mailer is a total fraud, you know, total fraud. Anybody that can put out a book on the beauty of graffiti has got to be a fraud. You know, it's the worst book of the year. And, oh, hey, swell, thank you. So, you know, graffiti is ugly. All these aerosol cans crapping up the atmosphere and ruining the places we live in. Come on, there's no beauty there. None whatsoever. Total liar. Yeah. Then doing that book on Marilyn Monroe, he didn't know anything about the woman. Never will know anything about her. So, again, this is all, this is cash talking, isn't it? All these people are selling out for money. They're doing the sex books and the so-called in things, and they're not in at all. All their books are going to be forgotten in a few years, so you better forget them right now.
Where did Martian Chronicles come from, the idea for them?
Oh, God, all over the place. Various influences, a lot of poets.
Yeah.
Stephen Spender, I used his name, Spender,
yeah,
as a villain in one of the stories. Lord Byron, one of his poems. Sarah Teasdale, one of her poems, influenced There Will Come Soft Rains. And reading people like, the Modern Temper, Joseph Wood Crutch. I read that book, I think, when I was 24. And it impressed me mightily. And I'm sure a hell of a lot of Martian Chronicles was spawned out of the impact of Crutch on my life. And Sherwood Anderson, Winesburg, Ohio. Mm-hmm. When I read that, I said, oh, God, I'd love to do a book of stories someday about people on Mars like these people.
Where'd you tie the House of Usher to Poe? I mean, you tied House of Usher and you used Poe in that, and then you tied them to a theme of some people trying to destroy creativity, I guess.
Well, again, see, this is the very thing we're talking about that you have to be aware of. We're surrounded by people who are telling us how to think and what to read and what to write. Mm-hmm. But you can't have a culture like that. Your art is all automatically going to be crappy. Look at Russian art as a result of their being repressive, telling the artists what to paint, and burning the paintings that they don't like. This is all in the headlines again the last few weeks. You cannot have a painting art like that, or a film art, or any book writing art. Most Russian books are total bores as a result of it, because they're all looking over their shoulders. So I was warning against that. I've been around too many sociologists who don't know their ass from a hot rock, too many psychiatrists too many literatures, you know. And I'm just warning you, stay away from them. And better than that, build a House of Usher, shove them in it and sink it. Huh? And shove them up a chimney, get an orangutan, wind them up, and send them out to kill these bastards. You see, like, that's what happened, remember, about 15 years ago, the comic magazines were destroyed by one man, Philip, Dr. Wortham, that jerk, huh? That intellectual jerk. He said, oh, these comic kids are bad for your, the comic books are bad for your kids. Burn, burn, you know, this is the good old burning mentality. And you got one murder somewhere that someone traced to a comic strip, huh? And that means you throw everything out. Well, in no time you have no books left. You have no culture, you have nothing. And thank God, the comic books are all making a big comeback now. But it's been a long fight. And this one stupid man did it almost single-handedly.
How did they affect your way of writing comic books? I mean?
Oh, a whole lot, because I started collecting them when I was 9. And on up through my teen years, I was just mad for Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and Tarzan. Jesus Christ, beautiful stuff. I still have all those early Tarzan Sunday panels put away, drawn by Harold Foster, who then changed later and did Prince Valiant. And I've been corresponding with Mr. Foster for the last 20 years, and he sent me original drawings of his. So I'm a child of movies and cartoons and science fiction and horror novels.
Who is the most, let's say, modern now, comic book you like now?
The ones that I did.
Oh, I would just point to my favorites in the paper. You know, I love BC and The Wizard of Id and Andy Capp. I think those are, you know, you just look for excellence wherever it occurs. These people have brilliant imaginations. They're very creative people. Their brilliance happens to take the form of doing a comic strip. But why should we look down on it? Because, it all started with Fra Angelico, huh? And people like that doing cartoons for the Vatican, the ways of teaching in the Vatican Museum and outside the museum. And even long before that, of course, back to the Egyptians and cave paintings. You know.
One more question, if we can.
Mm-hmm. I think the image most people still have of you, because the books that you wrote in the 50s and 60s are still everywhere, and I think a lot of people, that's their first impression they have of you as just science fiction writer. What kind of an image of yourself do you have?
I'm a student. I was thinking about that the other night, and I said, what? If someone asked me that, and you finally have, what are you? And I'm not a science fiction writer, a fantasy writer. I'm a student. God, that's a great thing to be able to say about yourself. And I don't say it in any fancy way, or it's just a secure, kind of warm feeling of that I'm still in and out of libraries and bookstores, and I'm still learning, and I'm still excited with ideas. And that's what a student is, huh? So God knows what new direction I'm going to take. Even I don't know, and I can't tell you. But if you remain a student, you'll find the direction. Good place to quit, okay?